Il-program li ser tisimaw huwa miġjub li l-kombi xew għat-tajba tal-Bank of Valletta. Campus FM jipprezenta Mhux kelma bejn tnejn, l-intervista tal-Bank of Valletta. Jipprezentaw il-program Father Joe Borch u l-Professur Joe Pirotta.
Jien Father Joe Borch nkien mal-Professur Joe Pirotta, nsidlukom għall-programm tal-lum. L-lum il-mistident għandu għall-ambasċatur Amerikan, Professur Douglas Kimmich, li fil-fatt miegħu nitkellmu iktar bħala Douglas Kimmich l-akademiku milli l-ambasċatur. Il-CV tiegħu huwa estensiv u mill-aktar interessanti u varjat, mhux qed ngħidu kollu hawnhekk għax inkella nieħdu parti sew mill-programm. Imma mill-mistoqsijiet li nagħmlu mit-tweġibi tiegħu kunu tistgħu tindunaw minnu aktar milli nista' ngħid jien f'din l-introduzzjoni. I welcome you, Mr. Ambassador. I was saying that today we'll be discussing more with Professor Douglas Kimmich, the academic, than the Ambassador of the United States.
Good to be with you, Father. It's hard for me to separate those two avocations, as you'll see.
Okay, true. We do not want a separation, but a distinction, perhaps.
It is an important distinction, and it's one that, in all seriousness, is important to try and convey to audiences as I address them, because an academic, of course, has, as indeed is invited by the very definition of the role, to be as provocative of thought as an academic can, to challenge presuppositions, to re-examine things that have become accepted nostrums, and these can be helpful qualities in a diplomat, but ultimately the diplomat also has to recognize that he speaks not just for himself, but for the policies of a nation, and I try and remind myself of that every time I'm about to say something provocative.
So you didn't share the populist definition of an ambassador as someone who lies abroad for the good of his country?
it's an amusing turn of phrase, and unfortunately I suspect there's more truth to that than not. And I think I've just committed an example of the professor speaking rather than the diplomat.
Okay, so let's go to the person even before the diplomat. You are a Catholic. You are very active in the...
Don't hold it against him.
You were very active in the pro-life group. You were also instrumental in drawing up the appeal by the Reagan's administration against the Roe versus Wade sentence, if I informed correctly.
Right.
And then all of a sudden you went to the other side. You started supported President Obama, at least that's how your adversaries describe you.
That's right. They describe it as a certain form of mental illness. But in truth, it's one is constantly examining how one reaches objectives. And if one is not reaching objectives, then one has to presumably either give up or find an alternative. President Obama, on the issue of life, presented an alternative, not a perfect alternative from the standpoint of the teaching of especially the American Catholic bishops, because President Obama is pro-choice. I am not. One of the things that the president and I have agreed to disagree on is this issue. But the president's perspective is one that I understand. It's a perspective that says America is a pluralistic place. It is not a place where there is an established religion or an established faith. Faith traditions differ as to the conception of when life begins in the United States, and the president quite appropriately, I think, indicates that as a matter of legal policy, as he pursues it, he has to accommodate more than one perspective. My response is to say, from the tradition of natural law, no, Mr. President, you're missing the objective good. Of course, natural law has difficulty in terms of proof, in this life at least. And as a consequence, the President and I found common ground over this method, namely that women don't come to this decision of abortion casually. Someone is not driven to take a life within oneself unless there's something wrong externally, for the most part. They're without a spouse, they're without shelter, they're without health care, they're without even basic nutrition for themselves or for their existing families. And so one could readily agree, I think, with President Obama, with candidate Obama, who said, let's address the poverty, the lack of health care, all of these conditions that promote abortion. And we can walk side by side doing those things and have common cause. Now, there may come a time when a particular issue would still divide us, but there is much to do on that common ground that hasn't even now yet been done.
Can I interrupt you? Because you have proposed a number of very interesting topics, the idea of natural law, the idea of common ground, which is one of the constant themes that President Obama is, and also the idea of compromise. And we live in a world dominated by sin, and so what kind of compromises can we do or we cannot do? And all of these would deserve a program on their own. So let me, before going into these questions, one by one. I will not be Machiavellian because you...
How come?
You were associated, to put it mildly and to do an understatement, with the St. Thomas More Columbus School of Law.
Right.
And this perhaps is a kind of interesting twist in your life, because Sir Thomas More also was faced with a situation where he had to do a kind of a very important decision. He said, okay, then I'll be silent, I'll say nothing, and I'll leave. And to be a little bit more Machiavellian, one of the characters is Richard Rich, and sort of he took a different decision. He stayed and he was promoted. Now, I'm not suggesting that sort of you sold your soul for Malta.
Well, you may not be suggesting it, Father, but more than a few bloggers have suggested it. But,
oh, really? I guess you would have asked for a bigger prize than Malta.
Well, Malta's a big prize, but because it has many qualities that are very attractive to me. But Sir Thomas More, of course, is the patron of politicians, of statesmen, of lawyers. All three groups claim him as a patron saint. I think if you carefully examine Thomas's life, you find someone who had an enormous respect for the rule of law and at the same time understanding of its limits. Thomas did everything he could to be both the king's good servant and God's. He didn't look for a controversy. When the oath was written, Robert Bolt's play does a nice job of highlighting this. He says to Margaret, what are the words? Mm-hmm. Margaret, his daughter, what are the words? And the daughter says, what do the words matter? Because Margaret's already at that point that so many people get to too quickly, and that is that we must find an absolute controversy between church and state, and that's where we have to push things. Thomas was of the view that, no, man is happier if civil order can be preserved, and so he was not looking for a way to put the church at odds with the state. He was looking for a way to harmonize it. Now, ultimately, he couldn't find it in the words, and he did have to make that choice. I would argue that in my circumstance, I found enough common ground to that Thomas would have made my choice. And it wasn't in the sense that I was saying, Mr. Obama, I'll be with you if you'll send me to Malta. I can tell you completely that as much as I love your country, now that I'm here as a visitor, it was not in my mind during the campaign.
this last point, I think it would be interesting for our listeners to try to understand the process by which somebody with your background, academic background, metamorphoses into ambassador for a country, in this case Malta. Could you explain how these things are done in the United States?
Well, ambassadors arrive in their position by two routes. So one is to be a career diplomat, mm-hmm. which was not my route. And I would say about two-thirds of our ambassadors are in that category. About a third of the ambassadors are appointed, and the percentage differs from political administration to administration, by virtue of the president having confidence in your policy judgment. Mm-hmm. And at that point, the president of the United States makes a determination of examining the needs of the United States to express itself in a particular way, in a particular place, at a particular time. So I think it's fair to say that the president and his advisors explained my appointment by virtue of the fact that I was his Catholic voice mm-hmm. during the campaign. He understood Malta to be a largely Catholic country that felt deeply about its faith tradition. He also recognized that there was a great deal of my career in the academy devoted to understanding the relationship between any faith, Catholic or not, and law and public policy, and that Malta, being the place that is everybody's pivot, it's the doorway to Europe, it's the doorway to North Africa, it's the doorway to Christianity, it's the doorway from which many Muslim individuals move into the European community, that's an ideal place for somebody who's been thinking about the cross-cutting influences of the world to be sent. So, quite frankly, it was the White House and the president who decided that this was a role that was one I could play. And that they wanted me to play. Now, they also, I will tell you, had a number of domestic things that they held out. This was more interesting. Mm-hmm. So there's an opportunity on that is presented by a new leader who's staffing up a new administration. Under our constitutional system, of course, the president nominates, mm-hmm. the Senate confirms. So the Senate has to agree with the president's judgment that this person can carry out the responsibility, and in my case, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and then the full Senate did agree.
If I may continue for a bit more on the ambassadorial side of your persona. You mentioned, when talking about your post in Malta, you talked of Malta as being the center of the cross-current, west, east, and so on. Which, to put it quite frankly, is sweet music to a lot of Maltese ears. But, and this is my question with a big but, to what real extent does a large country like the United States actually give importance to this geographical and societal fact?
This president and this administration gives enormous importance to it. I think in fairness, Professor, I would have to say that that would not be consistently true of every previous administration. I think it is an honest statement to say that if you quizzed many Americans about the location of Malta,
they wouldn't know.
They would not know. We have a hard time finding, you know, the place down the block sometimes. We need GPS devices to get us there. We're a big country surrounded by two oceans, and as a result, that produces an insularity of perspective that is not capable of being indulged in the European milieu, and certainly not in a country that's an island nation between the North and the South. But this president of the United States has made one thing clear, it's that America is a nation among other nations. It is not a nation that intends to act unilaterally. It's a nation that intends to act in conversation with, out of respect of the competing worldviews that it finds itself in. And one of the things that the United States recognizes about Malta is that it is indeed a voice to parts of the world that the United States doesn't easily find itself in, be it the Middle East, be it the Arab nations, be it North Africa. Notice that even in our military arrangements, we have long had a European command called EUCOM by its acronym. We have just now, in the last few years, created an AFRICOM to understand what the needs are of the United States for purposes of national defense and national security in that hemisphere, in that place. Malta represents, in many ways, a place where, if it's not paid attention to, it can be taken advantage of by drug smugglers, by people smuggling people, trafficking in persons, by people smuggling weapons, by terrorists seeking entry into the larger civilized world. And as a result, the United States, out of necessity, has come to have a better appreciation for Malta's strategic location, but also Malta's unique personality, a personality that draws upon both European culture and the culture of many other nations in the Arab world as well. And all of that is here. I can't say we've learned the nuances well. I can tell you that the ambassador is just reading and reading and reading and visiting and visiting and visiting as many places as I can to just try and absorb that. And at the same time, through cables and conversations back to the Secretary of State and to the President and to the National Security Advisor, to highlight the significance of this place at this time.
Jien fatt il-ġobor fi mkien il-Professur Perotta għal dawk li qed jisimgħu nista' qed intervistaw l-Ambasċatur Amerikan, Professur Douglas Kimmich, inkun nagħkom wara din il-pawża qasira.
Qed fittex biex tixtri l-ewwel dar, tibdil ir-residenza tiegħek jew inkella tixtri villeġġatura? Il-Bank of Valletta joffrilek opportunitajiet ta' selfa d-dar mibnija skont il-ħtiġijiet tiegħek. Kellimna llum. Bank of Valletta, impenn lejn is-suċċess tiegħek. Termini u kondizzjonijiet japplikaw.
Jien fatt il-ġobor flimkien mal-Professur Joe Perotta qed nintervistaw l-Ambasċatur Amerikan dwar għadd ta' suġġetti differenti. Quite naturally, Mr. Ambassador, as a professor of constitutional law for so many years, words are important for you like they were for Margaret, the daughter of Thomas, and you have put your words to writing on several occasions. One of the books that you wrote, and you wrote it during the electoral campaign, was called Can a Catholic Support Him? Asking the big question about Barack Obama. And in this book, according to what I was reading about it, you referred more than once to the book by Archbishop Caput, if I am pronouncing his name correctly.
I think he said Chapu.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Render unto Caesar to support your case. While he said about the way you quoted him, unfortunately he either misunderstands or misuses my words. And he couldn't be more mistaken. Not a light accusation to make? How do you react to it? Were you misusing his words? Sort of, were you misguiding Catholics and to vote for Obama?
I don't think so. I mean, I think there's an honest disagreement between the Archbishop and myself over this particular teaching, and that is that we talked before about truth and how we come to know it when we made mention of the natural law. The Holy Father, or the previous one, John Paul II, wrote an interesting encyclical called The Splendor of Truth. And it is a powerful, powerful essay, encyclical writing, that requires much study. But the fact of the matter is that in it, the Holy Father identifies a number of things that are intrinsically wrong, that simply cannot be justified by any contextual context. Abortion is in that category. I think where Archbishop Chaput and myself disagree, and where others in the American Catholic tradition disagree, is even conceding that abortion is an intrinsic wrong, what does that mean for the rest of Catholic social teaching? Does that mean you simply ignore it? Or do you have to come to terms with the fact that we live in an imperfect universe made up of imperfect beings, us, sinful beings, that only have the dimmest view of the mind of God, and have some obligation to act toward a family wage, toward to maintain the created environment in a way that shows respect for it, to welcome the stranger, to provide for health care, and you go down the list of things that build up a community and build up a person, and show the truth of the human person, as again John Paul's words would articulate it. It was my view in the campaign in that book, and I thought it was Archbishop Chaput's view in Render Unto Caesar, that one had to do a type of proportionality analysis. Indeed, that's what the American bishops use as terminology, to try and harmonize all of those obligations of Catholic social teaching and not become a single issue voter, as it were. Archbishop Chaput takes the position that if there is a candidate who is not right on a profound question like abortion, that you cannot take any consideration of his other positions. I take the view, informed, I believe, by the Gospel of Life, Evangelium Vitae, and the portions of that encyclical that say, when you're in an imperfect circumstance, as long as your position does not waver, your own witness, your own decision-making does not waver from the intrinsic truth, you can indeed accept less in the political milieu, because that's the reality of what you can get. Keep working, keep finding, keep using the mind, keep being, you know, here's Thomas More again, you know, God created us with wit, right? Mm. And we're to use that wit for God's purposes.
So am I understanding you correctly? You are saying my target is to reach 10. And I think that 10 is the right thing. But I think that in practical circumstance now I can only reach 4.
Right.
So I will make an agreement on 4, saying that I am not happy with 4, I want to reach 10, and by reaching an agreement on 4, I am doing nothing which will make it impossible for me to reach the agreement on 10.
That's exactly right. As long as I keep saying 10 is the result we should have, mm-hmm. is the correct result, but I'm taking 4 because that's what is available to me. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, the alternative is to sit back in the United States and say, well, I can't get 10, so I won't play the game. I get nothing.
You know, one interesting thing you've said, actually repeated, you've said it twice in different ways, is that one of the ways to get at what you want to get, and with which you agree with President Obama, is that you need to remove the fundamental causes of, for example, abortion, through education, welfare, and so on. Now, this word welfare, which, correct me if I'm wrong, but which for many, many years in the United States was a dirty word. And even though the Democratic Party in the United States is seen as the left in American politics, it has been the general consensus in Europe that if that is the left, what is the right? Now, this means there appears to be a massive shift here, even ideological, even in the sense of attacking the great American belief that you do most things on your own as the individual. What has actually brought this about?
In me or in the larger populace?
I think both.
I think, Professor, in me it was not a change so much as a remembrance. If you are formed in the Catholic tradition, you are formed in this understanding of your obligation of solidarity, of community. That is a major portion of our doctrinal teaching and our social teaching. In the 1980s, when I worked for President Reagan, I will say that the aspect that I found most attractive in his domestic philosophy was not solidarity, but subsidiarity. He came to office at a time when it appeared that too much had been centralized and not enough had been done to pay attention to the local view, to the view that says never arrogate to the higher level that which can be done more effectively below. And so what did Ronald Reagan articulate in the 1980s? The first word out of his mouth was family. In fact, this was the sum and substance of his philosophy: family, work, neighborhood, peace, and freedom. I think I found a good deal of identity at that moment in time between Catholic thought and that thought. But that point of view, as so often happens in our life, became radicalized. It became not a form of subsidiarity with the view of solidarity, but subsidiarity to the sacrifice of solidarity, so that it was man alone, it was man outside community, as if he could somehow separate himself, put himself above it. And it was Barack Obama who called the card on that one, who called the bluff, if you will, that, by the time 2008 rolled around, we had become heartless. We had not seen our interconnections, not only with others in the United States, but with others in the larger world. And the environment is a splendid example of that, but there are many others. And one of the things that Barack Obama believes, as a constitutional law professor himself, is that even as we must be careful in the exercise of power to divide the power so that no person can abuse it, we must not divide it so much so that it becomes wholly ineffectual, that government doesn't have the capacity to at least supply the material things that are necessary to allow for the exploration of things that transcend the material. In other words, that government can be used for the good. And that's not a view that's shared by the Republican Party right this moment in the United States. The Republican Party, unfortunately, unlike Ronald Reagan, who had an idea that we needed to give emphasis to the local to achieve the good, has the view that we just need to be left alone. Don't tread on me is their ideology. Well, that's an ideology of the caveman, and not of society. Whereas Barack Obama has returned the notion of solidarity and community into the vocabulary of the American political discussion.
Okay, you paid a price for making the shift, because on one occasion you were participating in the celebration of Mass, you were there, you went up for communion, and the priest refused to give you communion. How does it feel?
living in Malta in the 1960s.
Yeah, but okay, the personal feeling about it, of that moment.
You know, I have two feelings right this moment. I've been told by people who don't like this fact in my life to stop talking about it. Because they say, oh, you're whining about this episode. It was just once. Just leave it alone. I understand that perspective, and I try and only talk about it when someone asks me about it, like you just done, Father. And given your invitation to talk about it, I will tell you it is hurtful to this day. How could it not be? Because if you are a daily communicant, as I try to be, and as you stand in the line every day, you say to that memory will constantly come back. You know, when you come up with outstretched hand, and the priest instead puts his hand over the ciborium and says, "Not you." And you say, "I think you're mistaken, Father." He said, and when he says, "No, it's you that made the mistake by supporting Barack Obama," your world becomes topsy-turvy. Everything that matters to you at that moment is suddenly put on the block. Your wife leaves in tears. You stay because, well, she took the car. but frankly, you don't. Where are you staying? At that moment, you have been severed from the body of Christ, both in the sense of receiving the body, but severed from the body there present. And it is, as I've described it, the denial of communion is a weapon of intimidation that doesn't belong in the Catholic tradition. Now, the bishops of the United States are of different minds on this subject. I would say overwhelmingly most bishops would not exercise the discretion to deny communion for, among other reasons, even if the person was a reprobate. And how do you know in that particular instance he hadn't made himself at one with the church? You can't read the person's mind. Obviously, there are probably hypotheticals that the three of us could come up with where someone was of such great scandal that the receipt of communion could make an arguable proposition. I don't think endorsing Barack Obama was in that category.
Okay, there is a story about the cardinal in Chile, which once refused communion to Pinochet. I don't think that you are on the same level as Pinochet.
I would hope not.
Okay, we mentioned the idea of common ground. And also, this was part of the speech of President Obama in Notre Dame University. Can you explain a little bit more about Obama's ideas about this idea of finding the common ground?
Well, it is an idea that I saw on display more than once as I was privileged to campaign for the senator. He would go in deliberately to hostile places where he knew, like he did most recently, after the loss of the vote on health care. The Republicans invited him to a retreat. Their retreat, only Republicans in attendance, not thinking for a moment that the President of the United States from the other party would walk in. Well, there he was. He walked in. Because one of the things he understands is the human dynamic. And this is something that he has as a gift, I believe, from his mother, who was strongly of the view that you can only get along in life if you have a sense of empathy, if you stand in the other person's shoes, if you make the other person's argument, if you defend them even as it is antagonistic to what you would defend. And by that's how he prepares himself. He prepares himself by making his opponent's argument and having the opponent make the argument to him. And he listens very carefully. This is a trait that not a lot of politicians have. Most of the political direction for folks in public life is out the front and not in the side. And I watched him, for example, during the primary, in a room full of conservative, very, very conservative Protestant evangelical clergymen for the most part, listen. And at the end of that meeting, he said, well, I can see, you know, on A, B, and C, we have fundamental disagreement, but we've never gotten past C. We've been shouting at each other for years over those three things, and D, E, and F are unexamined and unattended to, and yet we have perfect agreement there. Why is it in this temporal time and place we don't grasp D, E, and F and get that accomplished? And it doesn't matter whether it was a labor subject, an environmental subject, an immigration subject, a question about how to run the economy. That was and is his method of operation. Now, the disappointing thing, I will say, I hope he's not listening to Malta Radio this morning, but is it hasn't worked well in the first year of the presidency. In part because the opposition, I believe, has caught on to the fact that he's seeking common ground, and they're not going to give him an inch of common ground. I mean, the general attitude of the Republican is the Republican Party is, we don't have to have ideas, we just merely have to say no. You want health care?
We're the opposition.
We're the opposition. We don't have to state anything. The burden's all on you. Get it done. If Americans are paying attention to that negative attitude, they'll reject it foursquare. But here's the difficulty. There's a lot of hurt, and economic hurt, in the American society, as there is in other places around the globe. But in the small community that my daughter practices law in, 24% of the community is unemployed. In Detroit, Michigan, well over 10% of the community is unemployed. The national unemployment rate is at 10%. And these circumstances don't permit sometimes the mind to work, because if you haven't provided for basic necessity, you're not thinking for the common good. You're thinking for individual survival. I'm hopeful that the president has, by means of his stimulus package, now redirected those expenditures toward immediate job creation of the most basic kind, so that many of the families hurting the most will be in a position to think more clearly and rationally and not be scared into the corner of voting for the opposition that is really an empty opposition when you come down and examine their platform.
Jien fader Joe Bolton kien mal-professur Joe Perotta fakru kom qegħdin nintervistaw l-ambasċatur Amerikan dak kemm hekk taw magħna kunu aħna nkomplu wara din il-pawza qasira.
Karozza ġdida, safra li jlek tistenna, id-dajsa li dejjem xtar, xogħlijiet fid-dar, apparat li ħares l-ambjent, amara, edukazzjoni, spejjeż tat-tieġ, kompjuter tagħmir tad-dar, saħħa, karavan, arti, apparat elettroniku. BOV persi lilhom, il-possibilitajiet toħloqhom int. Bank of Valletta, impegni e successtia, termini u condizioni ti applicavo.
Jien fader Joe Borg, flimkien mal-professur Joe Perotta, l-aħħar parti tal-programm mhux kelma bejtnejn intervista tal-BOV il-mistiden tagħna u l-ambasċatur Amerikan, il-professur Douglas Kemmick.
Ambassador, everybody who has met you that I've met as well has come away with, I think, the very strong impression of a person who is well-balanced in his thoughts, who is prepared to discuss points, not just, talk for the sake of talking, because we have known quite a number of ambassadors who are very good at talking and also very good at not saying anything when they talk. You have managed to talk and say something. Now, one of the things you did say, and which caused a certain degree of stare, was connected with Malta and Afghanistan, and which created the impression in some people's mind, or let me put it another way, some people sought to create the impression in people's mind that this was a direct, how shall I put it, a direct questioning by the United States, not just the ambassador, by the United States on Malta's constitutional neutrality. Would you care to enlarge on that?
My associate who's here is shaking his head no. I don't even have to look at him for that purpose, but here's where the professor and the diplomat come together again, or maybe have to be understood. The professor's side of me looked at the neutrality provision in your constitution and said, it's an interesting amalgamation of thoughts. I wonder what it means in practical application. And one could probably do a semester or more exploring the history of the origin of the clause, its subsequent applications and interpretations, and derive its meaning. So one side of me basically just simply wanted to know, what does it mean? How does it get applied in modern circumstance? It says quite explicitly that neutrality does not mean neutrality toward peace, right? It is a constitutional objective for the people of Malta to live in a peaceful world and peaceful society and to work for peace. Well, the situation in Afghanistan asks all of us, how does one achieve peace there and then in the larger environment? I will say, here's another place where the professor and the diplomat probably are in tension. My own view was largely humanitarian in Afghanistan, especially after what I perceived to be the error of Iraq, that the world community needs to build up the culture in that place so that we have people who are not subject to the whims and caprice and the violence of warlords. And so that the real answer in Afghanistan is not a military answer, but a cultural and a humanitarian one. The president, as you'll remember, took a good long time to decide what his own policy would be in that. And unlike a prior administration that just said whatever the military wants, it gets, the president heard from humanitarians, military leaders, sociologists. He consulted widely around the globe as well as domestically and came up with an amalgam of both military and humanitarian assistance for Afghanistan as his answer. And it was in that context where the neutrality issue first got raised, because a reporter quite naturally said, well, Mr. Ambassador, what can a neutral country do when the president is asking for help? And it seemed to me that a logical answer would be to say that so long as you weren't pre-committed in a mutual defense treaty, so long as you weren't asking for a military base to be constructed in Malta, so long as you weren't involving yourself in military operations even, it would be a relatively easy thing to conclude that civil governance matters and assistance and training for law enforcement. And it occurred to me, agriculture, people say, well, where's the agriculture component? I actually was thinking about the remarkable life science research that is being done at this very university, that in itself could be of use to a nation that needs to substitute an illicit and harmful poppy crop that is producing drugs and drug money for the support of terrorism that could be substituted with something else. So it had the answer, Professor, is that the teacher in me wanted to know the meaning of the words and wanted to know the history of the words and wanted to know what the modern application was from the Maltese perspective, with no preconception of an American prescription as to what it should mean. The diplomat in me wanted to conclude that at least, even without knowing the great history of that clause and what its modern significance is that the diplomat in me concluded that it didn't preclude Malta from being of assistance, and certainly in a non-military way, and some might argue in other ways, even so long as it didn't involve mutual defense treaties and things of that nature.
So it was mostly a personal initiative.
It was, oh yes, well, personal in the sense of the first part of it, mm-hmm. of wanting to know the complete meaning and history. There's no doubt but that the President of the United States and the United States wanted and does want help from around the world to have a successful conclusion in Afghanistan. And when I was back in Washington in January, it was brought home to me that no contribution of any kind that would advance the human good in Afghanistan, that would advance the cause of peace in Afghanistan, should be turned away, no matter how small in monetary specification or how unusual. Because, again, this is a president that views the United States not as conducting something unilaterally, but that we are indeed a nation among nations seeking to weed out those who distort the faith of Islam, who extort their fellow citizens, and who deprive them of any form of civil order.
Okay. We are in the last few minutes of the program, in the 4 minutes, so I'll put a question which the answer can be only a teaser to a fuller discussion. The Constitution of the United States, the preamble says, we the people, so it's we the people who decide. But should be this be appeal to we the people the ultimate? Do we the people have the right to decide what's wrong and what's right? Can anyone defend us from we the people?
We the people cannot be the ultimate, and indeed I would argue that in the United States it's not, that one really doesn't have a full appreciation of the American Constitution unless one starts with the premises of the American Constitution, which are found in the Declaration of Independence. And Abraham Lincoln put it best, that the Constitution, you know, it is sometimes said that an apple of gold, a word fitly spoken, is like a apple of gold in a frame of silver. I think that's the expression. And Lincoln said, let's remember, it's the Declaration of Independence and its premise that there are truths that are held self-evident, that men are created, that they're created equal, that it's from that fact of creation that they have basic human rights. That's the apple of gold. The frame of silver is the Constitution. The frame of silver, the Constitution, is a mechanism for advancing us toward the ultimates, not for substituting or displacing them.
Okay, so a short answer to a very big question, but a very thorough and profound answer. We come to the end
very
of our program.
Well.
Yes. I would like to thank you, Mr. Ambassador, for accepting our invitation and also for your answers. In Father Joe Borciu, Professor Joe Perotta, ringraziamo con il Samiatana all'attenzione tagħhom u namlu appuntament magħhom għal bħallum ġimgħa. Saħħa.
Għadkom kemm smajtu. Mhux kelma bejtnej, l-intervista tal-Bank of Valletta. Produzzjoni u prezentazzjoni ta' Father Joe Borciu u l-Professur Joe Perotta. il-program li għadkom kem smajtu kim iġjub li l-kom bix-xewqat tajba tal-Bank of Valletta.